From the Danker Studio on Library Square, this is The Rundown, an exploration of local news, current events, and issues that matter to you. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, we're going to continue a conversation that we began last week about the potential future for wolves in the state of Utah. Recently, a lone specimen from a northern Idaho pack made its way more than 800 miles to be caught on camera in Utah's Uinta Mountains. So, what does the future look like for wolf populations and wolf management policy in our state? Today we'll be speaking with Kirk Robinson, Executive Director of the Western Wildlife Conservancy, for his perspective. That conversation, plus a summary of your day's top local headlines and more, coming up just ahead on The Rundown here on KCPW. And thanks once more for tuning in to The Rundown this afternoon. I'm Roger McDonough. Coming up just ahead, a conversation about wolves in the state of Utah. But first up, we have these headlines. Early voting begins Tuesday across Utah. The state is opening up dozens of polling locations in the 2 weeks leading up to the November 4th elections to allow people to vote early. State figures show nearly one-fourth of voters cast their ballots this way in 2012. Early voting is one of three main ways to vote in Utah, along with mail-in voting and traditional Election Day voting. Mail-in ballots, which were sent out weeks ago, accounted for 18% of votes in 2012. Even more are expected this year, with 9 of the 29 Utah counties doing almost exclusive mail-in voting. State figures show votes cast at polling places on Election Day accounted for about 6 in 10 votes in 2012, down from about 7 in 10 in 2010. Utah Attorney General Sean Reyes and his counterparts across the country are calling on the U.S. Congress to pass a law aimed at reducing child trafficking. Reyes' office says the legislation pending in the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee would require websites offering adult services to verify those posting advertisements and the age of those appearing in the ads. Reyes says in a statement that human traffickers use the internet to offer children for sex. He and 51 other attorneys general from U.S. states and territories have signed a letter urging lawmakers to pass the legislation. And finally today, the Mormon Church is peeling back the mystery that has long surrounded undergarments worn by the faithful with a new video explaining the practice in depth while admonishing ridicule from outsiders about what it considers a symbol of Latter-day Saints' devotion to God. The 4-minute video posted recently on the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints website compares the clothing, known as temple garments, to holy vestments worn in other religious faiths, such as Catholic nuns' habits or a Muslim skullcap. It dispels the notion that Latter-day Saints believe the garments are, quote, magical, a stereotype perpetuated on the internet and in popular culture. The video is the latest illustration of the Salt Lake City-based religion's effort to explain, expand, or clarify some of the more sensitive issues within the faith. And that does it for our summary of the day's top local headlines. I'm Roger McDonough. This is The Rundown. Stay with us. Thanks again for tuning into The Rundown here on KCPW. I'm Roger McDonough. Last week on the show, we had a conversation with a biologist from the state of Utah about a recent encounter with a wolf from a northern Idaho pack that had made its way more than 800 miles to arrive in Utah's Uinta Mountains. Primarily in that conversation, we focused on that sighting and past sightings of wolves in our state. And today, to keep that conversation going, we're joined via the phone right now by Kirk Robinson, Executive Director of the Western Wildlife Conservancy, based here in Salt Lake City. Mr. Robinson, thanks very much for taking the time today.
My pleasure.
So there was a confirmed wolf sighting in the Uinta Mountains just recently. Was that something that that surprised you?
Not at all. At any given time, I think it's probable that there are one or a few wolves in Utah, and that's one of the places where they're most likely to appear. But it's a big area, almost 500,000 acres of wilderness without roads. It's not surprising that they travel through that country without being detected.
You know, I'd like to ask about the legal status of wolves in Utah. Do they have federal protection here, for example, or what does the map look like for wolf management in Utah?
A very small part of Utah, probably less than one-tenth, which is the part of northern Utah bounded on the south by I-80 as it comes down from Evanston to Echo Junction, and then from 84 as it goes northwest towards Snowbell and Strabel and the Idaho line. That part of Utah is within the what they call the distinct population segment of the wolf of the Northern Rockies. And when the wolves in the Northern Rockies were delisted 2.5 years ago by an amendment to a budget bill, it wasn't done by the Fish and Wildlife Service, by the way, as it should have been, but it was an amendment to a must-pass budget bill that delisted them, then wolves within that small part of Utah were also delisted. So any wolves that show up, for example, in Cache or Ridge County or Weber County are not protected under the Endangered Species Act, and they would be subject to whatever laws Utah has in place with respect to them. And right now, that law, as of, I believe, 2010, is that the Department of Natural Resources is to do everything in its power to prevent the formation of a pack of wolves in that area. Now, every place else in the state, including the Uinta Mountains, is a place where any wolf, whether it's from the Northern Rockies or a Mexican wolf from the Southwest, any wolf that should appear there would be fully protected under the Endangered Species Act. And this particular wolf that was sighted recently, if it had been captured and taken out of Utah, that would have been a violation of the Endangered Species Act.
There's a sense that wolves aren't wanted here in Utah. And in fact, the state legislature has over the years given $800,000 to a group to lobby to get wolves off of the endangered species list. I know this is something you've looked into. Can you tell us about those efforts and state funding for those efforts?
Yes. The first two $100,000 installments came from the Division of Wildlife Resources. Then the legislature approved a series of, I believe it was five payments, annual payments of $300,000 to the same contractor, Big Game Forever, to lobby in favor of wolf delisting, to work towards wolf delisting.
Right.
Only two of those payments were made so far. It was not renewed this year because $2 million state taxpayer dollars went to this essentially the same group under a different name to lobby against having the sage-grouse listed. So they're lobbying against, let's put it this way, threatening endangered species such as the wolf and the sage-grouse, the state doesn't want to have to deal with. So they are paying this group to try to bring about the delisting of wolves and to prevent the listing of the sage-grouse. So this indeed has happened. So the Utah state government does not want wolves in Utah. They made that point. So now we've cleared that up.
Let me just mention something, which is that the head of the Department of Natural Resources here in Utah, Mike Styler, said that these payments, because they succeeded in delisting wolves, you know, this was basically money well spent, and that we ought to keep funding Big Game Forever so that it can keep up its efforts. And a lot of this has to do with, or the argument that's made is that wolves kill big game, and that's a big industry here in Utah, as well as livestock. You know, what do you think of that argument against wolves?
Well, let me just first of all say that very sophisticated social science surveys have been conducted within the last 15 years. The last one, I think, was in 2004. In the first one in 1999, but they showed pretty conclusively, they were consistent with each other, that most Utahns, both in the south and in the northern part of the state, in the rural areas and in the urban areas, think wolves would be good in Utah, that on the whole, they're an important part of the ecosystem, that we should allow wolves in the state subject to some regulation. So that's what the citizens of Utah think. The leaders, our political leaders, are another matter. And yes, they don't want wolves. Why? Because they cater to two groups of special interest. And one of them is groups that are interested in primarily in big game hunting, especially trophy animals. And the main group there is Sportsmen for Fish and Wildlife. And also some of the agricultural interests, the Farm Bureau Federation, for instance, and the sheep growers and or the wool growers and the cattlemen's association.
Right.
They don't want wolves. But they are not a huge part of the populace of Utah. They're a very small percentage. And the thing is, our Division of Wildlife Resources caters to them. The Division of Wildlife Resources, by and large, when it comes to predator management, is a captive agency. they must do pretty much what these special interests require, because these special interests have a lot of power in the legislature. The legislature is dominated by representatives from the rural counties, for example. And so the Division of Wildlife Resources is not doing what the majority of people in Utah want when they pay out this money to try to bring about wolf delisting.
You know,
now, as far as big game goes, you know, of course, wolves eat primarily deer and elk. To some extent, they also eat moose and bighorn sheep and other native animals if they can catch them. But it's primarily deer and elk. And what are they supposed to do? You know, that's what they evolved to do. In fact, they evolved in tandem with those animals. Each species owes its unique characteristics to the other one. So wolves are an integral part of the ecosystem and of a healthy functioning ecosystem. Now, the fear, of course, is that there will be fewer deer and elk and bighorn sheep, et cetera, for hunters if we allow wolves to come into the state. Will there be fewer? I'm not sure that that's true. There might be, but it's not going to be dramatically fewer. And I'll tell you a reason why that is so. First of all, wolves, for the most part, do prey on non-productive animals, the weaker, the older, the sick, the injured, animals that are not going to take part in reproduction in the future. And they can scent those animals. They can pick them out. They're the ones they focus on in hunting because it's easier to kill them without being injured yourself. It's no good if you're a wolf having your teeth knocked out by the hoof of an animal because you will die as a result. So what wolves do for the most part is cull these unnecessary animals, unreproductive portion of the population. They do sometimes kill adult bull elk, for instance, when they're weakened after the rut in the wintertime and they can't get away easily. So they do that to some extent, but not to excess. We need to keep in mind, once again, that wolves and elk and deer, et cetera, evolved together. And we weren't on the scene with wildlife managers to make sure that they existed in proper proportion 10,000 years ago. Hmm. And yet for tens and hundreds of thousands of years, they got along just fine. Now, just one other thing. What can happen if you have too many deer and elk is that you have damage to their food supply, the plants that they feed on. This happened on the Kaibab Plateau in the 1920s. And as a result, there was a mass dying of deer and lots of erosion. And the father of modern wildlife management, Aldo Leopold, says, don't kill all the cougars and wolves there because that will lead exactly to this result. Mm-hmm. And so when the wildlife managers of Arizona began to see, indeed, that it was destroying the watershed and destroying the deer herd itself, they finally saw the light. But the fact is, we need top carnivores like wolves and mountain lions to prey on these animals, keep the herd sizes within a reasonable range. Now, one final thought on this. Without those top carnivores doing their job of policing the game herds, what happens is that game herds grow to proportions that are too large for the carrying capacity of the range. Then they destroy the range. They produce a lot of soil erosion. Then they die through mass starvation or disease. And then their numbers drop to a very low level, maybe even as low as one-tenth of what they were at their height. And then they slowly grow back up. So there are these huge swings, high peaks and low valleys in the populations of these animals without top carnivores to regulate them. Now, when you introduce top carnivores to the system where they belong, then the average number of deer and elk over the long run remains about the same, but the peaks and valleys aren't so extreme. So, for example, in Yellowstone, if you look at the data since somewhere in the 20s when they first started doing annual counts of the size of the elk herd on the northern range where most of the wolves are, there was a fluctuation between around 3,000 and 20,000, back and forth, back and forth. And sometimes there were so many elk that the park managers even allowed culling of the elk, shooting of them.
Right.
And there was a public outrage about that. But three or four times in 90 years, or 80 years before wolves were reintroduced, or however long it was, I've seen the graph in the spikes went from somewhere from 3,000 to 20,000 back down, back up, back down. And now what's happening is just that the range of extremes is much narrower.
There's a degree of stability there is what you're pointing at as a result of the introduction.
And one benefit of that is you've got a healthier watershed. You don't have the place denuded of plants and trees and so forth. And that's good for all kinds of other species that depend on them, including beaver, for example, that need saplings from cottonwood and willows, et cetera, to make their dams, which is good for fish and other aquatic creatures and for songbirds that nest in those plants. There are a host of other benefits, too. I think that all of this outcry about wolves being a detriment to the environment, to game herds, is simply based on ignorance. And I don't mind saying that even people in the Division of Wildlife Resources, if they want to disagree with me, then let them make their case. And I am sure that they cannot do it. But once again, they are simply politically unable to take a different stand.
All right. In the past, I know that hunting groups, the big game groups, have actually tacked up some pretty big conservation gains through their own work because they're out to see rangeland protected for the species that they are out to hunt. Is the situation here pitting groups who are otherwise allies against each other?
Well, maybe in some cases, but there are hunting and angling groups that are on our side on this. For instance, Backcountry Hunters and Anglers National Group, there's a chapter in Utah. It's only certain groups like Sportsmen for Fish and Wildlife, and a few others that take this extreme view. But I would readily grant that sportsmen groups, hunting groups, have been important for conservation. Teddy Roosevelt, who was a big conservationist in his day, one of the main forces behind conservation, and yet he was a big game hunter.
Right.
Aldo Leopold, the father of modern wildlife management, was also a hunter. And there are excise taxes on hunting and fishing equipment go to the federal government, and from those monies, there's money that goes to the states for wildlife management. But we all subsidize wildlife management through our taxes as well, to an extent. And there are other ways you can do it as well. For instance, I have a wildlife license plate I purchase each year for $30 or $35 or something. It's about the cost of a license.
Right.
It's not true that hunters these days are the only ones ensuring conservation. There are lots of different groups doing it.
Of course.
The Nature Conservancy, by protecting habitat, for instance, and groups like mine, which seek to connect vital habitat so that animals can move. All of us are doing some of the work, and it's wrong for hunters to claim that they alone are the ones responsible for conservation.
And I should remind our listeners that we're speaking with Kirk Robinson, Executive Director of the Western Wildlife Conservancy. We are running low on time, so I want to get a couple more questions in before we close up shop here. But in general, are populations of wolves on the rise in the West? I mean, I know that the reintroduction in Yellowstone was an incredible success, but how are wolves doing outside of the national park?
Of course, there are lots of wolves in central Idaho and in Montana, mostly western Montana, some in eastern Washington and Oregon, and each of those states has its own wolf management plan, and there is a degree of protection. So their population has spread. There's a breeding pair in western Oregon now, a pair that evidently made their way from eastern Oregon on different paths, but met up, and now they had pups this last spring. It could happen in Utah, too, in Colorado. One thing that makes Utah so important for wolf recovery is that the Bear River Mountains and the Uinta Mountains form a kind of landscape bridge between the greater Yellowstone ecoregion and the southern Rockies of Colorado, which could support maybe 1,000 of them. Utah could probably support a couple hundred wolves. So there's right now the population is roughly stable, but if states like Idaho have their way, it will fall steadily year by year. And none of those states are doing a very good job. Wyoming was doing a poor job, in my estimation, but recently a federal court overturned the delisting in Wyoming. So right now, wolves are once again protected in Wyoming. And within Yellowstone Park itself, where there is no hunting, the population rose quite high for a while, then it fell. And it seems to be stabilizing around 80 or 90. And that's what will happen everywhere. And the important thing to keep in mind here is that wolf populations are regulated by the abundance of prey. Wolves are never going to be too numerous. There will only be as many wolves as a prey source can support. Moreover, wolves generally don't like other wolves around. So to some extent, they even regulate their own numbers through fighting and killing.
Right.
They do not tolerate a lot of their own kind in a given area.
They require a lot of space for relatively small populations of wolves. Kirk, you know, I'm looking at the clock and we are low on time, but I did want to get in a couple of questions about your organization. How is the Western Wildlife Conservancy, how is your organization involved in, you know, in protecting habitat for a variety of species, but wolves in particular?
Well, I'm a member of the steering committee for the Western Wildway, which is a branch of Wildlands Network. Our project is to connect a chain of wildlands all the way from northern Mexico clear to the Bering Strait through Alaska, so that wild animals can move freely, and human beings too, places for us to hike and to engage in wildlife watching. This will help to ensure that these species do not become extinct in the course of time, especially with climate change occurring and the need for species to change where they live as habitats change. So I'm involved in various ways with that. I also pay close attention to what the Division of Wildlife Resources does. In many cases, I applaud them and help them. In some cases, I'm on the other side of the issue, and that happens to be the case with the wolf issue.
Right. Finally, we mentioned the conversation about sage grouse. There are other species out there that are threatened or endangered. And people are even fighting over those species, but it seems like that's nothing compared to the amount of passion that people feel about wolves on all sides of the issue. What is it about wolves that elicits so much passion in people?
I thought about that a lot, and I can think of a few things. I'm not sure it's just one thing, but of course we do have our stories, The Three Little Pigs and Little Red Riding Hood and such. I remember having my mother read me those stories when I was young, and a lot of us do. Another thing is, during the westward expansion, when people relied mostly on their own domestic animals, such as cows and sheep and goats for sustenance, after they'd wiped out the buffalo and other game herds, wolves did start feeding quite a lot on the domestic animals. And so the owners who relied on them for their own sustenance understandably came to resent that and wanted to hunt and eradicate the wolves, which they did by the 1930s.
Right.
But the situation is entirely different now. I would mention one other thing, and that is wolves, Canis lupus, and on the other side of that, Canis familiaris, the domestic dog and all its varieties. The domestic dog apparently evolved from wolves, and yet we say our species tends to hate wolves and love dogs. Dogs are man's best friend. And I think that itself is sort of a curiosity. It's hard to know why that is so. But the idea of our dogs, what if our dogs were to form packs and start hunting us? The idea is a little scary, and maybe that's right. Part of the answer of why we love dogs that are actually friendly toward us and hate their wild ancestors.
Interesting.
Wolves are capable of killing and eating us if they chose to. Fortunately, that almost never happens, but the thought can be kind of scary, I'm sure.
Right, and we do have the holdover of the sort of mythology of them being an enemy, as you mentioned. I'm just going to remind our listeners that we've been speaking with Kirk Robinson, Executive Director of the Western Wildlife Conservancy. I really appreciate your talking to us about this fascinating issue, and who knows what we'll see in the future when it comes to wolf management and wolves in our state.
Yeah, I hope we have wolves before long. I think it would be a good thing. But thank you very much, Roger. I enjoyed it.
And you've been listening to this conversation on The Rundown here on KCPW. I'm Roger McDonough. We'll be right back. Thanks again for tuning into The Rundown this afternoon. Our show today was produced by yours truly, with additional help from Ross Chambliss, Ryan Cunningham, and news intern Mycel Spotted Elk. Our theme music was composed by Tim Myers. Tune in each weekday at 5 for an exploration of local news, events, and issues that matter to you on The Rundown. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned next for the Utah Business Report and Marketplace.